Good evening, I'm Bob Bazans and I'm an alcoholic. And I've been sober for 14,006 days. It started on the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. This is a terrific conference. I've been to a lot of conferences. There's a wonderful feeling about this conference. There's a kind of a sense of joy, you know, it's kind of light. It's a nice facility. It's planned well. Everything about it is very cool. You've had great speakers, and you have been a great group of people to receive those talks. A lot of people don't realize that a lot of a talk has to do with who you're giving it to, you know, because there is a person who's trying to give the talk, and then there's a group of people who are receiving it. And if you don't have people who can receive it very well, it kind of bounces back at you or it goes nowhere, and there really is kind of a spiritual connection, I think, that happens when things go well, and you can kind of sense that in the collective consciousness of this room. So it's been very cool. Thank you for for paying for us to have a guest. I brought my wife with me. Linda, would you stand? And Linda has over 38 years in Al-Anon. And I have been a constant source of growth for my wife. I don't think she'd have half the program she has if it wasn't for me. And she would say that she might not need the program she has if it wasn't for me. So, I was supposed to come with my, Linda and I were supposed to come with my sponsor, Warren. My sponsor is 86 years old and he has 51 years of sobriety. And I've had him since I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is kind of unusual that you get to have someone that long. And he was the guy, my host this weekend is Lenny Z. The quality of the conference has been wonderful until I got Lenny as a host. But Lenny, my sponsor helped Lenny sober up. Lenny calls my sponsor two or three times a year. And when my sponsor hit 50, Lenny at his own expense came out to Minnesota for a backyard party for my sponsor. I like that gratitude. I just think that's very cool. And I've been privileged over the years to, he had Warren come out and talk at his group. You know, just nice things. You know, things, how many people that pass through a detox would go back and pick that up? Not many. You know, that's classy stuff. And I love Lenny and I love Pat. And it's been nice spending time with you. I've enjoyed all the speakers. It's really been a nice weekend. I don't know if I'm getting older or I found myself crying through half the talks, which were not sad talks at all. I just find myself kind of being affected by them. I'm touched with how we kind of surround alcoholism. You know, we all have bits and pieces of it. It's like turning on a different light source on the moon. You know, Bobby shines it one way and Jane shines it another and Kitty signs, you know, everybody's got a different way. Carl was wonderful. As tired as he was, I knew that was why he was a little flat. Probably explains why he turned on Harlan. Kind of an Al-Anon move, Carl. But at any rate, I want to thank Harlan and James and Mike and Don for chauffeuring us around, just all the people who have put this conference together. It's classy and you do it really well. And I hope you keep it well. It's interesting. I have just recently talked at an annual event in Austin, Texas, and Intergroup let it die, and they're just resurrecting it. I just got asked to talk at a roundup that was one of the nicest, largest roundups in the country, in Dallas, that died, and they are resurrecting it. And we always assume these things are going to be here forever, and they aren't. We need new blood. We need some old blood. We need, you know, people who want to keep it the same. And what happens is I think people get involved in the nitpicking little sorts of things and lose the sense of joy and don't have enough fun. But I get a sense, I get a sense like you're still having fun, which is really, you know, which is really cool. So keep doing that. I started drinking when I was in high school. I was a freshman, 14 years old, 13 or 14 years old, 4'11", 95 pounds, mostly mouth. And I was a small kid. God, I was the second smallest kid in my high school class, and I just hated that. And I was, you know, I always felt like everybody else got to school an hour early, held a meeting, and decided what to do for the day, and I always missed the meeting. It was like everybody else knew what to do, and I didn't know what to do. And so I just tried to be what I thought she wanted me to be, and I was always the kid who had to have everybody's attention, do the daring thing that no one else would do. And somewhere in my freshman year, my buddy, his dad died, and he went out, and he got a fifth, and we went out, and we split that fifth, and my life changed. I mean, you've heard that story in lots of different ways. When I took alcohol inside of me, all of a sudden, I didn't feel like I was a member of the group. I felt like I owned the group. It just kind of, I mean, it really was more like a sex change operation than an improvement. You know, I mean, it really, it was transformational. It was not, you know, incremental. It was a big deal. And when you get something like that that kind of makes you feel on the inside like everybody else looks on the outside, you just try to do it as much as you can. I went to a military high school and a college campus. We drank in high school like most guys drink in college. We had fraternities. Of my high school class of 118 guys, there are, I think, a dozen members of AA. Of my five closest buddies, four of us in our AA, one's in Al-Anon. He was my college roommate. two of our spouses are in AA also. So I drank my brains out. I got in a lot of trouble. I thought the trouble was that I was underage. I never, you know, between the police and my father, I was always in trouble. I just, you know, just thought I had bad luck. Had a chance to go away to school. It was a big part. I wanted to get away from the authority of the police and my father, and I went away to school, and I thought my drinking would change. My drinking didn't change. It just got worse. I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I am in the yearbook. I have my class ring. I am the class drunk. I started out, that was a big deal. That was my parents thought that was cool. And, I mean, they used my room as a study hall. You know that movie Rudy? You know, he went there. I passed through. You know, I mean, it was, that's what you get when you're an alcoholic. You don't get a life. You don't get to have the experience that you're supposed to have. You just get little trinkets, little bits and pieces. I don't know what. And I had three guys petition to have me removed from engineering school. I was due to be commissioned as an officer in the Army. I had to get a medical release. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19. That seemed goofy to me. It just, I mean, it seemed inappropriate. It seemed like the wrong diagnosis. It didn't seem possible. But it got me out of the service at that point in time. And I came home. I finished school at a local university. When I finished school, my father, I'm one of seven kids. Irish Catholic, you know, we had those large families, you know, if you had less than seven kids, you just had a lot of miscarriages. They were, I mean, they were just, you know, 9, 10, 12, 14, 7. I mean, it was just, you know, almost, you know, everybody. It was wonderful. They were just, families were friends of families. You know, I'm from a kind of a small, St. Paul is a smaller of, you know, the Minneapolis St. Paul. Sort of thing. My dad just came to me and said, Bob, we love you, but we don't know what to do with you, and we'd like you to leave the house. And I, good luck. And I, now as a father, with Linda and I have three sons. They are 36, 34, and 25. They are sober 17, 18, 14, 15, and almost 8 years. So there's a number of things about that. One is that Linda is a carrier, I have. None of us were alcoholic when we met her. Kind of like Typhoid Mary. It just, you know, she never got the disease. She just kind of spread it wherever she went. And the other is you, it would be impossible for us to be able to express the gratitude that we have. Those are interesting that both Al-Anon speakers this weekend were children of alcoholics and spouses, possibly. But when your children have the disease, you would do anything. You feel responsible and you have no control. It's even worse, I think, a worse degree because they're children. And they don't want the help from you. They have to get it from someone else. And it is, you know, you are the people that got our children well. And there is a debt of gratitude that we have that we will never be able to pay in that. But when you have children like that, which it's kind of a karmic event, I got to experience firsthand what my parents experienced, and it isn't fun. And so my dad asked me to leave the house. I got a job at a liquor store. I worked at the liquor store. Have to use your gifts. And I was, I worked at the liquor store, I guess, for about, this is the last year of my drinking. I worked at the liquor store 6 months. I got arrested for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck. I'm drinking a fifth a day. I am, this last year, almost no one knew where I was. I just kind of hid out, didn't want anybody to kind of know. I lost that job. I took a job as a waiter. I'm working on, not Skid Row, but close. I'm, you know, $10 a night rooms. I'm shacked up with waiters and waitresses. You know, Dr. Seuss, the child author? Those are actual photographs of people I lived with during the last year of my sobriety. And, towards the end of my waiting job, and I was the world's worst waiter, you know, it was just bad. And I went to a party and I got my face kicked in. When I got my face kicked in, I got fired and I had no place to go and I was tapped and I went back to my family and I asked if I could move back in the house. They allowed me on the condition that I wouldn't drink. I could move back in the house. And when I moved back in the house, I tried to change my life. I really hated being the family problem. I didn't like getting the look from six brothers and sisters and parents. I mean, it was just, you know, once or twice a year, the police would bring me home, or I'd get in a car accident, I'd be in the hospital, and they'd come around, and, you know, you were the subject of the conversation, but not a participant in the conversation, and everybody trying to, you know, your mother's crying, your sisters are crying, you know, brothers want to kick the hell out of you, and no one knows what the hell to do with you. And when I moved back in the house, I really tried to start my life over. I had, you know, I figured if I could change the circumstances of my life would get better. Carl talked a little bit about that. I got back together with Linda. I'd gone with Linda for 2 years. We broke up for a year, and then I'd call her like a low-grade headache. She was just she'd start to date someone else. Just about the time she'd start to date someone else, I'd call her up and just kind of check in with her. And I went to her, and I asked her, I was at a party, and just after I had my face kicked in, I drank myself sober. I've only drunk myself sober twice in my life, and I drank about a quart and a half before I went to that party, and I wasn't sober that night. That was a different night. That was a different night. That was the night you couldn't understand me, right? Yep. And so this is the psychiatric nurse that agreed to consider to marry me the day after I was drunk that quart and a half and spent the night at a party with my face kicked in and she couldn't understand me. So nothing wrong with Linda other than her. We became engaged, we married. I got a job as an executive trainee in a manufacturing concern, bought my first car, and I thought, wow, I'm finally going to get it together, only I couldn't shut my drinking down. I was I just could not stop drinking. Now I'm in a company. When you're in a company, they like to have you come in on Mondays, like to have you stay on Fridays. They got lunch hours, you know, and I am using up my sick leave in the first 3 months of work, and I'm falling asleep at my desk. I'm sleeping. I got a buddy who's dying of cancer right now, and he was the photographer at that company, and he'd hide me in the dark room, you know, when I was, you know, drinking, or, you know, he'd hide out. I quit that job at 6 months. When I went back to make my amends to that guy, he said, I couldn't believe it. He said, you interviewed so well. And She gets prizes for interviewing. And I leave that job. I get a sales job thinking it's going to give me a little more flexibility. I'm on that sales job about 3 months, and a buddy of mine gets married. I go out on about a 3 or 4 day drunk. I wake up after the bachelor party after a, you know, pretty long blackout, and I haven't been to work in 3 days, and I wake up, I don't know if I have a wife, a job, or a place to live until I'm married, and that's an economic necessity, and all of a sudden, the idea of calling AA didn't seem like such an impossibility, and I called AA. And I got an old-timer at Intergroup. He got me on the phone, he talked to me for about 15 minutes, and then he got on another line and called a couple of guys and wanted me to go meet a couple of guys at a cafe, and I said I would. He gave me, you know, told me where to go. And, you know, I called home and found out that they were more concerned than mad, found out I still had a job, found out I was still engaged. And I thought, why the hell did you call AA? And, you know, and the only reason I went to go see those two guys is that I wanted to go see what they looked like. I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like. No denial in my... And I went, sometime in July of 1967, I went and I met these two guys. One guy had 6 months, one guy had 6 years. Warren sponsored the guy with 6 years. And they sat me down in the booth and said, we're from AA. And they said, we had a drinking problem, we found an answer in AA, and we want to tell you a little bit about it, and we hope it helps you, but if it doesn't help you, for some strange reason, it helps us. And we stay sober when we go out and tell other people about what we're trying to do. And, you know, when you're young and in trouble, you get put in front of an awful lot of people that want to help you. Doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, and bishop, nun, priests, and psychiatrists, and psychologists. And I'd never, ever talked to another person who had a drinking problem. And in about a matter of an hour and a half, these two men, by telling me their drinking story, gained my confidence. And I found myself nodding and agreeing and sharing stuff that I'd never shared with anybody. We have many traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the most wonderful ones of which is that we share our experience, strength, and hope, and not our philosophy. You know, we don't teach, we share, and there is a power in those two men sharing their life with me because they changed my life that night. That night I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank twice after that night, once with a month of sobriety when I went on a business trip to the West Coast, and I was told to call AA and didn't, and drank and got in some trouble. And then I had about 3 months of sobriety in December, and we went on our honeymoon. And I think in the back of my little mind, I had always planned to drink on our honeymoon. And it's kind of subconscious rather than conscious. And we honeymooned in Acapulco. You know where the divers dive off those cliffs in Acapulco? They showed it in the thing. I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. And... I went over and introduced myself to the ex-president of Mexico. His nephew had been my roommate at Notre Dame, and he was not impressed. I was drunk. I would do not picture graceful. This is the ugly American. I took off my Bermuda shorts. I had a swimsuit on, thank God, underneath them. Dove off the public landing, climbed up the cliff, split my swimsuit, cut my leg. My wife's going absolutely nuts. I get up about 90, 95 feet. I get stuck. I can't climb down. I'm looking, watching the waves, trying to figure out what is a jump or dive, and finally figured out the hell with it, and I dove, and God watches after fools and drunks, because I made it, and we started to do a vacation there after about 5 years of marriage, and we brought the kids down there every year, and one year we were standing, she gave me a picture of that chasm at La Quebrada, and it said, on the bottom it said, but for the grace of God. And at midnight, we were watching the divers dive one night, and I said, God, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done. And she said, honey, it's not even in the top 10. So, no, you don't need it. I don't know how you can share a life and see it so differently. It's, So I had my last drink on the airplane on the way home, December 10th, 1967. I was kind of embarrassed to go back to the group, but Linda said, for God's sakes, call Warren, and I called Warren, and I went back to the group. I remember when I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I met Warren and the other guys that were in the meeting, and we had a party the other night. This is 38 and a half years ago, and we had a party at our house, and there were 8 people who were at my first meeting, and they were mostly spouses. The guys had died, which is kind of the reality of the world. The last guy in that group, other than Warren, died last week. And, you know, when AAs die, it's like a celebration for all of us. I mean, it is, you know, It's not as sad in some ways, because it's, we did enough dying and our drinking. You know, there was something about the joy of how we lived our lives, and the guys that know how to live know how to die. And this guy was a great guy. But I remember Warren sat me down in a chair and he says, Bob, says alcoholism is a disease. It's physical, but it's also mental and spiritual. Once you're crossing the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time, when you're drinking and when you're not drinking. That was like rocket science. The idea that my alcoholism could affect me when I was not drinking was an idea that I had never had before. So what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is once we take our last drink of alcohol or our last drug, we use the 12 steps of recovery to change, to find a different way to live that's a better way to live, so we don't have to go back to drugs or booze to do something for us that we were unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. If you don't change, you're not going to stay. And I think that is... You know. So I launched myself into the program. My sponsor was the most active member of AA in our group. He was a 12-step champion. I started to go out on a lot of 12-step calls, and I started to do the things my sponsor did. Today I've been privileged to have a lot of experiences in AA, and every one of them is because my sponsor kind of led me into that experience. When I came into AA, I said, okay, I'll buy it. People have been telling me I got a drinking problem. I thought drinking was going to be abstinence. I thought that, you know, I thought we'd be talking a lot about how not to drink. We talked not at all about how not to drink. I'd go to the meetings at 8 o'clock. I'd come home at about midnight. We spent almost all the time after the meeting talking to guys about problems they were having at work, paying their bills, doing eighth and ninth step stuff. I very quickly got the idea that this was about living rather than just about not drinking. And that was, of course, what it was about. So my idea was, okay, I'll buy it. I got the problem. If I got the problem and you got the answer, I got about a half a dozen other things that are going on in my life that are driving me nuts. And if you got the answer, those things ought to be cleared up. And it might take a year. They didn't get cleared up in a year, and they didn't get totally cleared up in 38 years. My problems were horrible but ordinary. I had trouble getting up in the morning. I later found out that had something to do with when I went to bed, but at the time, I did not know that. I had money problems. I spent about $300 more a month in 1967 than I made. If you do that over a long period of time, you will end up in debt. I just want to report that to you in case you're running that one and you don't know where it's going. We started to have children. We had Billy and Peter, and I had great parents, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes they did, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes my parents made in a bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, immature, angry, and sometimes violent with my children. I am not proud of that fact, but that's an accurate description of how I was. I had some work problems. I had a little trouble getting to work. I had some issues about staying at work, and I had trouble working at work. Other than that, I was a good worker. I interviewed well. And I used to say I didn't have marital problems, but Linda would say, yes, you did, you just didn't know it. That was the other one. And I had a gambling issue, more of a hobby. It was four or five hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It wasn't a big deal. But I was making $5,000 to $10,000 a year playing backgammon, and it was kind of like a second job. Now, I had all those problems when I did my first inventory, and none of those were on my first inventory. My first inventory was a writing down of the worst things that I had done and how badly I felt about them. You know, it wasn't, you know, I mean, I read the book. I read the 12 and 12, tried to figure out how to do it. I did the best job I knew how to do it. I wouldn't go back and do it. But, I had very little insight into the causes and conditions when I did my first inventory. I didn't have a very good sense of my defects of character after I did my inventory because it wasn't a very insightful inventory. But during my first year, I was kind of on a honeymoon. I liked everything about AA. The gift that I got when I came to AA is I felt home from the moment I walked in. It's been tough for me to do the work, but it's never been tough for me to go to the meetings or to stay in AA. It's been a place that, you know, I work with lots of young people in those first few years, and I had trouble getting them to go to the meetings, getting them to stay at the meetings. And, you know, some of them needed it a hell of a lot worse than I did, and they were smarter than I was and had more to lose. And, we could say they weren't ready. I don't know what it was, but for whatever reason, I consider what happened to me to be a gift. I was allowed to stay. And one by one, I got my defects of character handed to me. One by one, I kind of take them on, and I'd work on them. My first, by the end of my second year, I got a pretty good list of what doesn't work in my life. I got a pretty good list of my defects of character. My third and fourth year, they start to bother me. In my fifth and sixth year, they're really bothering me. And in my seventh and into my eighth year, they're eating my lunch. I've been a guy now for my first couple of years. I went to five or six meetings a week. I probably have gone to four or five meetings a week my entire AA career. And I'm sponsoring guys, I'm giving talks, I'm active in service, I'm doing I'm doing the deal. I think I'm doing, pretty much what everybody's patting me on the head, telling me what a good job it's doing. And in my middle years of sobriety, after people stopped paying as much attention to you, I felt like I was going backwards. I felt like I was on the down escalator going up. Every time I took a breath, I felt like I lost something. A new guy, my sponsees were making more progress than I was making. And the new guy'd come in, and I'd get him a cup of coffee, and we'd sit down, and he'd share that bushel basket full of manure that we all walk in the front door with, and he'd tell me about, the girlfriend or the wife or the police and the IRS and all the stuff, and I'd say, hey, I know it's tough, but you're in the right place. I'm really glad you're here. Get a cup of coffee, sit down. If you stay here and you get in the book, you get a sponsor, and you try to do the, you don't even have to do it perfectly. You just do the best you know how to do, you're going to be okay. You see that guy over there? God, 2 years ago, his life was an absolute mess, and now it's just fine. You're going to be okay. And I'd get in the car, and I'd drive home, 11 o'clock at night, and I'd say, Bob, when's it going to be okay for you? You're sober 5 years. When are you going to learn how to work? Everybody knows how to work. I didn't know how to work. You just charged a $400 sport coat at a store that you had a $500 bill at. When are you going to quit buying things you don't need with money you don't have to impress people you don't like? Didn't have an answer. Cecil Corrigal, 1969. And I didn't have an answer. As my defects of character came on and I worked them pretty hard, and I really tried to make progress in those things, and I wasn't making any progress, and I felt like I was getting to be a bad member of AA. I felt like maybe I had a story of my life. I start well, I don't finish well. So now I'm in AA 4 or 5 years. I feel like this is just another deal that I interviewed well, I got in, I'm moving ahead, and I'm going backwards. It's the way it always is. I can't do the job. It seems like everybody else is doing okay. Everybody's telling me I'm doing okay, and I'm saying, Christ, can't you see me? Now, I was telling my sponsor about 65% of what's going on. And I know in Oregon you do 100%. And I think that's I think that's really very good. The fact was, as I was telling myself about 65% of what was going on, you don't see it with much clarity what you're going on, which is why you need a sponsor and why you need an inventory process. I was the one who expected my life to be perfect. My sponsor didn't expect me to be perfect. Today, when I'm sponsoring 25-year-old guys, I don't expect their lives to be manageable. But when I was 25, when I was 26, and I was 27, I was expecting, you know what I thought recovery was? I thought recovery was the absence of problems. You laugh? I mean, I must have made that up. I don't think anybody told me that, but that's actually what I thought. I thought if you had a program, you could get rid of your problems. I mean, I guess I'm an idealist, or I don't know what the hell I was, but I actually expected that if I would take these steps and do these things, my problems would get solved. And I felt like a jerk that I'm in AA 3 years and 4 years and 5 years, and it seems like my problems were getting worse. I paid all my bills off in my first year, and by my seventh year, I'm in as much debt in my seventh year as I was when I came in. Doesn't feel like progress to me. And I got a problem. And I know by this time I figured out that, the guys that really got it going on are the people who have a spiritual life. They know what God has to do with Wednesday. I had some issues. I was a Catholic. It was a very important part of my life, and once I found masturbation and drinking, I just kind of drifted. It was just kind of wasn't a good, I just didn't fit in as well as I wanted to. And So I had some irresolution with respect to the church, and I just kind of put it on the shelf. In the first couple of years, I was very uncomfortable with, you know, most of the stuff that was going on. When they talk about God, I'd kind of, we had an upstairs and downstairs, but we split into two. If the meeting got too spiritual, I'd kind of drift to the other meeting, you know, and we'd go downstairs to the first step. And the problem that I had is I knew that if I went to God, knocked on the door, and God said, "Who's there?" I said, "God, it's Bob." He said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want to turn myself in." I said, "I'm 7 years old, 7 years sober, my pants are on fire. You know, I'm working my tail off. I'm doing all the things that I think I'm doing, and I feel like I'm going backwards. I want to turn myself in, because the guys and gals who I think really got something going have this spiritual thing going, and I want to sign up." And God's going to say, "Fine." And then I'm going to ask God what everybody, what all the new guys and new gals ask their sponsors, "What do I do?" And God's going to say, "Get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. Get out of budget." That's a tough word. I think that's an Al-Anon word. I mean, it's a harsh word, I think, for most alcoholic. You know, be kind and loving to your wife. Quit gambling. And be gentle with your children. And I'm going to say, you know, if I could do all those things, I wouldn't need God. I mean, so the problem I had is, what is the sense of going to God and turning yourself in if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what the hell your higher power wishes might be with respect to your life. I mean, I knew what, I had a sense of right and wrong. I had a sense of where I wanted to take my life. I just couldn't take it there. And I'm feeling like, you know, do I leave AA? Do I go to Gamblers Anonymous? Do I go to Spenders Anonymous? Do I go to Angry Anonymous? I mean, God, if I, you know, had to go do 90 and 90 at all of those, you know, I'd be lucky to be able to have a job. And I'm, at 7 years sober, I'm not thinking about drinking, but I'm thinking about suicide. This is not a small deal for me. AA was important to me, and I feel like I'm failing. The truth was that I wasn't failing. What was happening to me is, you got me well enough and honest enough that I could no longer stuff and deny the things that were going on in my life. So what was happening to me is I was putting, my nose was being pressed up against what was next. If you're going to start a spiritual journey, what's going to happen to you is you're going to run into what's in your way. And so it wasn't getting worse, it was getting better, but it looked unpleasant because I was being pushed into what I had to deal with next. And I find it not to be unusual that many of us between 5 and 12 years of sobriety, our pants catch on fire and we got a second group of stuff that we have to do. It is phenomenal, the changes that I see happen to people in their first 2 years and 3 years of sobriety. It is as powerful as anything that we see. They are miracles. We see transformations that are astounding. But there are a lot of people who, after some period of time, leave Alcoholics Anonymous because of the issues they have subsequent to that, and they feel like they're either not doing a good job or AA doesn't work. And that is, I think, is equally as challenging to us. I remember when I was delegate, Dr. Jack Norris, who was the chairman of the board of AA, they had a meeting on why are people leaving AA? And I'm 13 years sober, and I'm just, you know, I made Carl look lethargic. I vibrated. I was just, you know, I was everywhere. And I remember saying, "They're not leaving AA." He said, "Oh, yeah, they are." I said, "No, they're not. I mean, I go to, you know, 4 or 5 meetings. My meetings are growing and they're going. But our survey would show that we have a fall off in people's participation in Alcoholics Anonymous after 7 or 8 years of membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. When we go to conferences, you can take a look. Where are all the, you know, where are some of the people that are in their more mature years of sobriety? You know, we have holes sometimes when we stand up in groups, depending upon the event and how it's going. And I think that this is one of the reasons why is that, you know, there's a number of reasons. I think if you don't work with people, AA gets boring. I think if you have to get involved with people, or it doesn't stay vibrant and it doesn't stay new. And by the way, I mean, I sponsor a lot of guys. And when those of us that are up here, I think sometimes talkers don't realize what exceptional members of Alcoholics Anonymous they are. It's pretty hard. I compare myself to Carl and Bobby. I got an ego. You know, I mean, you get, you know, most of us are not intended to sponsor as many people as Carl does, or as I might do. But if we just replaced ourselves, for God's sakes, if we just replaced ourselves, we would be the most successful organization in the world. And sometime during the 30 years that we get to sit in these chairs, if we just grabbed, now, if we got the experience to sponsor one or two or three people and replaced ourselves, it would be the best. And what we run into is people who, some people sponsor 15, 20, and 30 people, and other people are worried about whether that's their ability to do. And not everybody can do those large numbers, but it is something. I know that if we had our hearts open, you'd find someone just by paying attention and just by being nice to them, you'd pick up that person and you'd find that person who you have a special way of touching. And I think each of us, when, you know, Kitty talked about hidden gifts, I think each of us has that gift to touch another human being. And there is nothing sweeter than having a conversation with someone and saying something that you did not know and having it be exactly the right thing to say at exactly the right time, and it came through you and you had not a bloody thing to do about it. And you just go, you know, it is, you know, very cool. So I'm an AA, I'm 7 or 8 years sober, and I'm dying. And I go to my sponsor, and I literally do not know what to do. And what I did is I started back through the steps. It wasn't very hard for me to figure out step one. I was powerless, and then I was unmanageable. That was obvious. Step two was the step I lost. Blew my mind. I got into step two, and I took a look. I didn't believe step two for me. I believed it for you, but not for me. I actually could put my hand on a lie detector and you say, do I believe God's going to restore you to sanity? The answer is yes. Do I believe God's going to restore Bob Bazan to sanity? The answer is no, because I'm 8 years sober and my life's going backwards. I lost that belief. And when you get in trouble, I think you get more or less active. I got more active, and all of a sudden I started to see people in my groups with bigger problems, with smiles on their faces, walking through the issues I was trying to avoid with dignity. And all of a sudden, I came to believe that God would restore me to sanity. I had to reclaim that. I took step three on my knees with my sponsor in his office. We didn't do that in those days, but I started to go to conferences. I listened to some people in California, and they were doing that. And I thought, well, it's a little much, but but we didn't do that much. You are here, you know, so I did it with my sponsor, and, you know, I'd taken the third step. But I got down on my knees and we did the third step prayer, and I started to do my fourth step, and this is my third fourth step. I did it with my sponsor, and the other two I did with clergy, which was our custom. And when I took my fifth step with them, I said, be careful, because when I'm done, I'm going to do whatever you recommend I do. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I said, if you gave me a test and asked me what to do, I could tell you what to do. I know what to do. I just can't do it. I'm so tired of me. I can't tell you how tired of me I am. And when I was done, we cried and talked a little bit, and one of the things he wanted me to do was go to a psychologist. I had a lot of issues about work. I had a successful father. My idea was I'll never be as good as my old man. He was kind of my hero. Not kind of my hero. He was my hero. And I don't know what my expectation, I just thought if you could survive to be an adult, you'd end up being vice president of something. And now I find out you actually have to perform to, actually, this is not good news. And life was quite a bit harsher than I expected. And so I had issues about success and failure and money. And I didn't want to go to a psychologist, but I told him I would. So I got a name, a guy in our group was a, worked for a big company. I got a name of a psychologist. I called a psychologist. He said, will you get your parents involved? I said, no. I said, my parents have been over-involved in my life. He said, will you get your wife involved? I said, oh, crap. Well, they see it so differently. Maybe more honestly. I said, yeah, I'll get her involved. Will you get the kids involved? I thought, they're pretty young. He said, well, I'd like to talk to them. I, of course, did not want to bring them because I was occasionally abusive with my children, and I was embarrassed about that and ashamed of it, but I said I'd get them involved. And I can remember we were at this guy's office, seventh or eighth visit, and my company's going broke, and I don't know why I'm busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day, and it's just, it's not not working, and it's and this guy looks at me in front of my wife and children and says, "Why are you so afraid of failing?" And I wanted to hit him. My first reaction was I just wanted to hit him. And I said, "Look, jerk," I explained, "you're a doctor." I said, "When you fail, when you go bankrupt, you just take your little sign, walk down the hall, pound it on a different door. Within 6 months, you're making 100 grand again." I said, "I'm in the real estate investment business, and I'm just about to lose everything I have." Nod your head up and down if you understand that. "I'm going to lose everything I have." He looked at my wife, and he said, "If Bob loses everything he has, will he lose you?" And my wife said, "Nope, won't lose me." He looked at Billy and Peter, and he said, "If your father loses everything he has, will he lose you?" And the kids said, "No, wouldn't lose us." If you can't lose, you can't play. Now, I'm the guy that we're going to have a marathon. I'd have a great pair of tennis shoes, nice pair of shorts. I'd look and talk and act like a runner. I tell you, I run some race in Minnesota, and you'd expect me to be in the top 10. When the race took off, for the first third of the race, I'd be up front. And somewhere between a third and three quarters of the way through the race, I'd fall down and I'd hurt myself. When the race is over, you'd say, "What happened to that guy from Minnesota? Hell of a guy, won some race. I don't know, you know, must have pulled a hamstring." But if you were following me around in a helicopter in my life, you could have guessed within 50 yards of when I would fall down, because I don't finish anything. We are spectacular. We are good at doing the spectacular. What we can't do is the ordinary. We can't get car insurance. Okay? We can't, you know, I mean, we can't do the ordinary things, you know, can't keep a job, can't keep a relationship, can't stay married, can't balance a checkbook, can't be ordinary. And each of us has one or two or three stories about how spectacular we are, that we dive off cliffs, that we win prizes, that we get into the toughest schools, that we were a jet pilot. And we're sitting there with crap in our trousers, you know, trying to explain. No, but I mean, we are, it is interesting because we are not under-equipped. We are not short of talent or ability. We just can't live life on life's terms. We are scared to death. I go to a sober house and I put a meeting on Tuesday nights with a group of guys. And I think the biggest issue is that a lot of these people are just scared to death to face life. Because as soon as you get sober, what's going to happen to you is you are going to be up on the firing line, and then once you're sober for a while and you start to expand your life beyond the sober house, you're going to be smack dab in front of what got you in the sober house. You're going to be smack dab in front of what doesn't work, what you're afraid to death of, again. And if you don't have something between you and you at that point, that's a dangerous spot. Not too long after I was with that psychologist, I went home, and it had been a bad day. I went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game, won $600, missed dinner, missed the AA meeting, got in a fight with my wife, and slapped one of the kids. One of those great days you wish your sponsor would come in through the front door. They send a videotape to the General Service Office to show what 8 years can do. And I said, "Gee, it happened again." And I said, "It happened again. Weren't you there?" I said, "Yeah, but it's so habitual. It's almost like I go into a blackout." And all of a sudden I realized that was a bunch of crap. My life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was. It sounded like I wanted to quit gambling. I wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble, for as much money as I wanted to gamble, without having problems with gambling. I wanted my wife's and children love and affection without spending time with them. I wanted money without work. Not a very good design. And all of a sudden, I realized that I had tried pretty hard to clean my act up, and I had failed. And for some reason, that was okay. That had never been okay. My problem, if you would have asked me to put it in words, I had a mantra. My mantra was, you are an asshole and your life doesn't work. Now, if you use that over a long period of time, you get a low self-image. But that literally was my mantra. There was some, I had a built-in failure mechanism. I started well, but I didn't finish anything. And that day I said, you've tried pretty hard and it hasn't worked. And it seemed okay. And all of a sudden I realized that maybe I was where I was supposed to be, and I was given the opportunity to take the sixth and the seventh step of the program of AA. The sixth step said that we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. The seventh step said we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I had spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I do not have the power to get rid of them. I'm responsible, but I am the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. A doctor doesn't heal. He creates an septic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed, creates a fertile environment, growth can take place, and God grows, and we don't change in the way we think we do. We develop an attitude of mind and heart, maybe the attitude of the sixth and the seventh step, of the three requirements of being honest, open-minded, and being willing, and God changes us. You read what... Stick my glasses out of that thing, will you? One of my favorite paragraphs, I can probably read that. That's my big book. I don't know where the hell they are. But I think most of us want to change. Most of us want to, and that's what I'm going to talk about for the last half of my talk. My favorite paragraph of the big book is on page 84 and 85. And it said, we have ceased fighting anyone or anything, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will return. We are seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it like a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We find that this has happened automatically. We see that our new attitude of liquor or living, when we read this with some of my sponsees, you could put in gambling, sex, internet, money. We find that our new attitude towards liquor has been given to us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We're not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It doesn't exist for us. We're not cocky, and neither are we afraid. This is our experience. This is how we react as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Does that sound like you have special insight? Does it sound like you have special technique? And what most of us are fighting for today is technique. We want someone who gives us a better technique on how to inventory. I want to go to a class on the big book so that we can do all this. And all this is good. But does this sound like you're a technician? This sounds like your heart was touched in a way that you were changed. That it was almost passive. That we opened ourselves up, and the change happened to us. And I believe, in a very significant way, that's how transformation happens. It doesn't happen by information. It doesn't happen by intellect. It doesn't happen by our power. It happens by our lack of power more than anything else. It happens by our willingness to submit ourselves and find out how bloody hopeless it is. And it is bloody hopeless. That night, I got down on my knees and took the sixth and the seventh step, and four of the major problems I was dealing with in my life disappeared that night, such as the power of AA and such as the power of God. Now, in order to keep those changes intact, because I'm a guy who makes lots of promises and often is not able to keep them, I went to my sponsor. I made a deal with my sponsor about when I'd go to work, how long I'd stay at work, and what I'd do at work. I gave my wife the checkbook. I went on an allowance. My wife doesn't have the issues with money and ego and spending that I had. She had us out of debt in about a year. And she had this ability, she could pay a third of a bill. God dang this thing I have ever, I mean, I... oh, I started dating my wife. I dated my wife every Friday night for 25 years. And I had her love and affection. It was everybody else's love and affection. But we were, all of a sudden, we found ourselves with kids, and we're going out, and we're talking about money and bills and kids, which is not how we fell in love, I promise you. So we started to go to Chicago and shack up for the weekend, or go out on a date. It was a real live dangerous date. No one else went out on this date. We dressed up. We had each other's undivided attention. It was one of the best things we have ever done. We had to create a romantic environment for ourselves and recreate an atmosphere in which we had affection and romance and cared for each other. I spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better parent. I think having kids is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. I think it's the most demanding process. I think it takes 125% of whatever you have. It is one of the great, I mean, the school in life is in relationship. You want to know where your life is? It's in relationship. You want to know where to take your inventory? Take it in relationship. The unavoidable relationships. Carl talked about his old man. You can't, what you end up with the unavoidable relationships, husband and wife, father and son, parents and children, and children and parents, you run into you. At work, you run into you. So, my life took off like it was on a rocket ship after that. The promises started to come through. I started to go through, and I did another series of amends, and for the next 10 years, I made enough money to burn a wet elephant. It was kind of a combination of being in the right place at the right time in the real estate investment business, and it was a combination of all of a sudden what happened to me is my power was restored. My integrity returned. I became a whole person. My gifts became available to me, and I was able to operate at a level that I had not been able to operate. I remember when I was in the car going out to sell an investment that I knew a man would not buy. And I'm in the car in the parking lot at a major company, and I have to go up to the 13th floor to sell a guy something I don't have enough money to buy. And so I'm reading the third step prayer, and I get out of the car, and I go up there, and he forces me to sell it to him, and he buys it. And it was a $10,000 investment, and I made $1,000. And I'm on the elevator going down, and I have this thought, gee, if a guy did that regularly, so the next 10 years I get the big house, I got two Mercedes, I got lots of things, fancy vacations, fancy clothes, I'm the guy in the fancy suit with the fancy tie, with the Mercedes coming to the meeting thinking that God's blessed me because of what such a wonderful program I have. How would you like me in your meeting? There are problems with failing. There are problems with success. There are issues with arrogance that I didn't even, it was invisible to me, did not know I had it. 1986, they passed the Tax Act, and between 1986 and 1991, I go broke. I lost $8 million in 3 years. It was like tearing the skin off my body. If any of you are out there praying to become a millionaire, you might include the thought of keeping it. It never occurred to me to add that clause. About the time I started to go broke, I went to a man and I asked him to be my spiritual advisor. He said, what do you want? I said, I want to be more loving and less materialistic. Within about 6 months, I started to lose everything I had. True story. I went to him and I said, we got to talk. I said, I want to be less, I want to keep the stuff and be less materialistic. We laugh about that today, but it wasn't very funny then. Today I would not trade the lesson for the money. I'd take the money and the lesson, but I would not trade the money. When I lost that money, we had a big house, and we had to sell the big house. It was not a big deal for Linda. It was a really big deal for me. We had to move down the block. As blessed as we were, now the house is perfect for us. We bought a Rambler. Nice Rambler. But I am dying. I am hiding out. I can't go play golf. I can't go. I'm in a city that I've lived all my life in. I got kids I went to high school and college with that I sold investments to. Some of them aren't good right now because the real estate market's collapsed. I am in tough shape. And when you're in tough shape, you either get more or less active. I got more active. And there is no better place in the world to get healed than Alcoholics Anonymous. You people just healed me. I would not be alive today, I promise you, if it wasn't for my wife and Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thinking about chewing on my gun quite often during that period of time. It was about as hopeless for her. But if you're thinking classy, I was under my desk in the fetal position sucking my thumb for a year and a half. And I'm not a guy who is very passive. And I was done. I mean, it was as bad as it could get. And about that time, Peter, the middle boy, came home from college, got arrested for drunken driving, totaled on an automobile, and ended up in detox. And he went through treatment, and he went to a halfway house. And we go to that halfway house for a meeting, and I'd cry through the entire meeting. They start the meeting, I just would start crying. Can't you see the guys at the meeting? See that guy over there? He's got 25 years, you know. How'd you like to have what he has? I think he's got the clap. I don't know what the hell's wrong with him, you know. And I had to find out who I was with and without money. I don't think God had the real estate collapse to teach me that lesson, but I think my lesson within the real estate collapse was that. And I made it through, and so life, recovery is not the absence of problems. It is that we have a program and the ability to be able to deal with life on life's terms as it comes at us. The power is not ours. It comes through us. We're like sprinklers. We all have different patterns and different holes, and we show up, and most of us don't have any water coming through because our sprinklers are clogged up. We do a little bit of inventory and open up some of those holes. We start to see the pattern as God would express him through us. And I really believe that that's what we are. We are individualized expressions of God. I used to think of God as a third party. You know, was it Jane that talked about the bearded old man in the sky? And I think a lot of us have personifications of God in them. With the work that I've done spiritually, I'm starting to believe that who I am in the deepest essence of my being is God. I'm not trying to be blasphemous when I say that, but my spiritual advisor would say, you are, everything you are is God. You aren't everything God is. But if I took a cell out of your hand, everything, that cell wouldn't be everything Bob Bazan's was, but everything in that cell would be Bob Bazan's. He said, you are made in the image and likeness of God. You are spirit. You are a spiritual person having a human experience. And I believe that rather than a human person having a spiritual experience, and I believe that though we get touched, there are moments where we know that. We know that is right. We just know that is true. I like what someone said once, you can only learn what you already know. Don't you have that experience in AA? Don't you have that experience when you're listening to Carl or Bobby when they give the talk? That part of what was impacting me today with Carl is your gift of language is so and humor. The combination of is so edgy that he kind of very sharply and quickly outlines something, but it, encapsulated in it is just this piece of truth. And it just, you keep experiencing it, just bam, bam, bam. You keep experiencing those little pieces of truth about our program. And, you know, that's the gift. That is really very cool. But haven't we all sat at meetings where someone will say something you have never heard? And your soul just goes, yeah, yeah. And it just fits. You don't have to think about it. You just know that it's so. That's what I think. I get every once in a while when I'm given a talk at a treatment facility, I'll draw a circle and I'll say the circle, in the circle is everything there is to know. Then I take a piece of pie, I say, that's what you know. Then I take another piece of pie and I say, that's what you don't know. Now there's two-thirds of the pie left. And that's what you don't know and don't know you don't know. Not a joke. That's what you don't know and don't know you don't know. And in our fellowship, most of what makes a difference is what we don't know and don't know we don't know. It comes from not our intellect, not information. It comes from some other place, at least intuition. It touches us in a way that we've not been touched before. So my life has been a series, you know, my life is so good today I can hardly stand it. It ain't perfect. You know, I'm overweight, I smoke. That's just because my wife wants me to. I've tried to quit a couple of times, but she doesn't want me to. And she's not smiling, so that is that. So I'm not problem-free, and I'm not missing any information about smoking or being fat. I'm not missing any information about what my higher power would like me to do in those two arenas of my life. I'm just, right now, not able to do it. And I have thoughts about it, and I have intentions about it, and I occasionally have done, you know, I've had 8 years and 2 years and 1 year about not doing it, and right now I'm not able to not do it. And there are times where that feels like I'm not a good AA. There are times it feels like if I had a program, I'd do it. But you can't summon surrender at the snap of a finger. I remember one time Chamberlain... I remember one time Chamberlain was going to give a talk at the Peachtree Conference or whatever the hell it was called, the one that the doctor had in Atlanta, and he was... They had all the experts from around the United States in the field of alcoholism went to this place, and he was going to talk to them. And he normally didn't do things that weren't kind of, you know, mainline AA, but he did this. And I remember a couple of months later, I was at another conference with him, and someone asked him, Chuck, how was that conference with all the experts in alcoholism? And as he was sometimes and often able to do, he can put his finger kind of right on the core. He said, they don't know much about surrender. I mean, that's our access. I mean, when the guy or gal comes over to our house and gives us that dump, you know, once in a while I say, hey, quiet down. And pretend that I just came over to your house with the same problem. What do I do? They always know. We always know what to do. We just can't do it. You have to die before you can live. You have to surrender. But how do you tell someone how to surrender? So one of the things that's going on in our fellowship today, as our fellowship grows, we are, you know, one of the movements that I see in Alcoholics Anonymous is a movement towards orthodoxy. We see it in churches, and we are not immune from orthodoxy. The idea that if you're not doing it this way, you're not doing it right. We're starting to use the book like some of the harder Christians use the Bible. We're starting to beat each other up with the book. I know some people who have memorized the first 164 pages and teach it, and I would no more want to go on a fishing trip with them than the man in the moon. I wouldn't want to be married to some of them, and I wouldn't want to do a business deal with them. Okay. What we are talking about in alcohol, and wait a minute. That is not any slam about studying our book. It is not any slam about trying to get into the book and learn how to do the steps better and do the work better. That is our text. It is God-inspired. It is as profound and as deep a work. You know what? One of the characteristics of great spiritual works is every time you read them, they're new. Every time you read them, they're new. And isn't it astounding how, for some of us that get into the book on a regular basis, how new it is, how regularly new it is. And it just is astounding. Okay. But I want to say to myself and to all of us, is what we are trying to do is not memorize the menu. We're trying to get the nutrition. The book's the menu. It's not the food. The food comes from putting the principles in action in our life. Now, I promise you, if we had a manual on how to fly a jet airplane, I think if I spent enough hours with you, if I were an instructor, which I'm not, and if I had all the information, and I spent thousands of hours teaching you how to fly an airplane with a book, you'd get to a point where you really would feel like you could fly that airplane. And I think there's a world of difference when we put your bottom in an airplane and turn on that goddamn engine and send you off after the thousands of hours you studied it, and you get up there, and I mean, that's what AA is like. I mean, when you get out in life, and life is fired at you at point-blank range. There is no preparation for life. There are divorces, there are deaths, there are bankruptcies, you get fired, you end up with cancer. Life is just fired at you, and there's no readiness for it if you aren't connected. But if you're connected, it's okay. You have a place to stand. You are not alone. You are in the moment, and you are present. If you are not in the moment and you are not present, what you are is you are inside your little tank looking through the slit with your machine gun, looking at everybody else's tank, wondering about who to take out and who not to take out. Those are the two. What Chuck used to say, you can have a God-centered life and suffer the consequences, or a self-centered life and suffer the consequences. Today, you know, we joke about the committee. We joke about, you know, our minds are driving us absolutely nuts. The incessant thinking that we're going through is absolutely, and that is the purvey of the ego. That conversation, your internal dialogue, is the conversation of the ego. You are not the thoughts and you are not the thinker. If you are the thinker, try to stop it. Okay. For those of us that have tried meditation, you can't. No, you can't. You think you generate your thoughts. You don't. Once in a while, one comes through that's got Velcro, and you attach yourself to it, usually one that has to do with you, and you get fascinated with it. But you do not generate those thoughts. Okay. So what do you get when you get a newcomer that comes over? What you get is a dump. You get the internal dialogue put on loudspeaker. Okay? Now we laugh about that, but that's what we get when we're not centered. We get all that crap that's going through the pipe, and when you grab a hold of that, and that's where you are, that's your reality. That looks like it's real. And there are plenty of days. My life is as good as it gets. And 2 months ago or 3 months ago, I went down to the lake and gave myself my undivided attention for about a week and drilled myself so goddamn far into the ground, I could not believe it. I mean, it was bad. So you take a negative, ugly, damaging thought, and you take it from here, and you put it there. That's all you see. And keep it there for a period of time, and you can end up in a mental and spiritual state of shape that is just dangerous. Okay? But there's a place to stand. What we are is the observer of our thoughts. What we are in that position is more spirit than anything else. And when we're in that place, we're present and we are able to attend to life. And what does our program say about change, and what does our program say about getting our lives back? It said having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. So what the process is of recovery is being more awake. I still have some of the same issues and some of the same problems I've had in my life. But I don't act on them with the regularity that I used to, and they don't own me the way I used to because I am awake. I have a tendency towards anger, but I do no longer strike children. Wouldn't it have been wonderful for Mr. AA, the big talker, whose kids all had alcoholism, to get to a point when they needed recovery, they didn't want to come to recovery because what a horse's ass I was? That could have happened. Okay. So today, because of you, and because I got a place to go and discuss my life, and I've got steps and principles to put in action in my life, and because I have a sponsor and because I try to work with other people, I am in the work. I do it imperfectly. No one owns it. From time to time, we can get up here and sound like an expert, but the fact is, when we're all flying jet airplanes and we're all living our lives, I promise you, there are times where it's plenty dicey. If you've got teenage children, there's nothing very controlling about that. When you have a 15-month-old child, it seems like you're the best parents in the world, but I promise you, it gets more complex as time goes on. No, it just does. It's like, you know, and getting old isn't as easy as it is. When your health starts to go, when your sex drive starts, I mean, as you get to a certain point in life, what you start to experience is little deaths. Death of your virility, death of your athletic ability, death of your some of your mental acuity. Carl's case, but it's... But it is, the reason our program works and the reason our program is transformational is because we are not the source of the power that acts in our lives. We are the vehicle that brings us to the source. And if we can somehow maintain an attitude of surrender, which you can't tell someone how to do that. So we have all these tapes out in the back that has Bob B. on the 12 steps and Carl M. on the 12 steps and Bobby C. and, you know, Janice. And I mean, we have, there's everybody. It's not mechanical. It is good to get that information, and it is good to hear someone who is experienced and expert and a good teacher. But if it were mechanical, which a lot of us are looking for, throw me some tips, let me see what I did wrong. Okay. Every time you had a problem, all you have to do is say the third step prayer and click your heels and you'd be back in Kansas. I'm not kidding, but there are times when you go say the third step prayer, no one's home. So when you go to take the steps, it isn't as much about doing as altering how you be. It's an alteration in being, and when you alter how you be, what you do changes automatically. So we have to bring something to the process, some surrender, some openness, some honesty, some humility, some way of being in that process so that we have a change of heart, which is what I think, in a way, is almost what happens to all of us in that process, is a change of heart, an opening. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to practice, you know, carry the message to other alcoholics, and practice these principles in all our affairs. The line I love in the book is when Silkworth says you can rely absolutely on anything these people tell you about themselves. If we could live our lives that way, wouldn't it be wonderful? I love the gifts that we have. I love my life. But today I'm in love with my wife. I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. I got a good relationship with my kids. I would have none of that. I have lived most of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have a life if it wasn't for what you have given me and what has been available in these rooms. I know more about who I am when I'm in this room than any other place I am. I know more about it than who I am as a business person, who I am as a father. This is my place. This is my place. Thank you for my life. Oh.